This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, why a new superbug has health authorities around the world on high alert. And in Indonesia, it's also election time as frontrunner Joko Widodo declares the campaign a time to party. Not everyone is buying the festive mood.
His opponent, Prabowo Subianto, had earlier addressed some 150,000 people packed inside Jakarta's main stadium.
I am disgusted. Saya muak.
I've had enough, he shouted. This is not the republic I defended. It's not the republic I risked my life for.
Today was supposed to be the first full day of the election campaign, according to many political pundits. Even though the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is yet to take C1 for a drive to Government House at Yarralumla to visit the Governor-General, it's beginning to feel like the campaign is already underway. Joining me now is political reporter Tom Eagledon. And Tom, the starter's gun hasn't been fired on the election, but what signs are there that we're in election mode already?
Well, Sabra, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison's office has already been pretty secretive about his travel schedule. For one thing, a classic sign of an election campaign, as that office looks to not give an advantage to the opposition by letting everyone know where the Prime Minister is and what he's up to. On the Labor side, we've seen, of course, lots of pictures of Bill Shorten jogging around, another classic sign of a party trying to portray the image of a leader in waiting, energetic and ready to go. Interestingly, though, Sabra, there has been a bit of speculation in the Courier Mail today about the reason for the delay to the apparent delay to the election being called, and that is to do with the Adani mine up there. The suggestion being that, as we know, Melissa Price, the Environment Minister, is still yet to give the go-ahead for that. There is apparently some pressure coming from Queenslanders for her to make a decision in the positive on that. I've spoken to one Queensland backbencher today. Look, I think it's safe to say that though he was pouring some doubt on that speculation, it could be said that there is a great deal of focus from the Queenslanders on this Adani mine. There is a great deal of pressure on Melissa Price to make a decision. And though he doesn't think that that was a reason for the delay, perhaps this is something that we need to keep an eye on for the next couple of days looking ahead.
With the shadow campaign already well underway, what is the betting now on when the election will actually be called?
Well, the pundits, of course, have been wrong about when the election's going to be called. But in terms of the likely election date, I think May 18 would remain the most likely there. It seems to be the clearest date. If you go after that, the weekend after that, May 25, that would not give the Australian Electoral Commission much time. They'd have about a month to count what could be a very complicated Senate voting ticket and that wouldn't give them enough time before the July 1 deadline to install the new Senate to count that. May 11, the weekend before, also presents some difficulties in that the Prime Minister would pretty much have to go to the Governor-General tomorrow to call the election. That should have been done on Sunday, you would think, if he had wanted that election date. So that seems unlikely at this point.
Even though politicians say the only poll that counts is election day, they do pay an awful lot of attention to opinion polls, and two of them are out today. What do they show?
Well, they're very broadly in agreement here that Labor is still in a very healthy, commanding position as we enter this election campaign. News poll has them 52-48 ahead. Ipsos in the Fairfax papers has them 53-47 ahead. Now, there was a slight uptick for the government in the news poll result, though in polling, as we know, the trend really is your friend. And the trend has not been good for the government for years now, particularly since Scott Morrison took over last August as Prime Minister. The needle really hasn't been moved to any great extent in that news poll result. And you would have to say, though, there has been a slight budget bounce, the likelihood of that carrying through to the May budget in a meaningful way that would produce an election-winning result for the government is pretty remote, looking at these figures today,
yeah,
Sabra.
One of them does suggest a budget bounce, but it's a rare thing that there is actually a budget bounce.
It is, it is often talked about, but rarely seen, the budget bounce, that's right.
Tom Eagledon, thank you very much. The federal government needs to urgently change sentencing laws for minors convicted of terrorism offences because they breach international laws protecting children, according to a powerful independent watchdog. Limiting access to parole and bail clashes with the International Convention on the Rights of the Child. The findings will put pressure on the federal government to change the Crimes Act. Political reporter Melissa Clark.
In the past, it was rare, but now it's not uncommon for children to be committing terrorism offences. In the last 5 years, children made up more than 10% of terrorist convictions in Australia, with jail terms of up to 13 years being handed down. The laws around prosecuting and sentencing children for terrorism have been reviewed by the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, James Rennick SC. He found a number of areas that need to be changed. Under the Crimes Act, anyone jailed for a serious terrorism offence is only allowed to apply for parole in the final quarter of their sentence. Dr. Rennick finds that when this is applied to minors, it is
in breach of Australia's obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child,
because it doesn't allow the judge to give enough consideration to what's in the best interests of the child. He says the matter
ought to be addressed and urgently.
The Australian Human Rights Commissioner, Edward Santow, agrees.
The Convention on the Rights of the Child is clear that a court must always consider the best interests of a child as a primary consideration.
Bail is only granted to people charged with terrorism where there are exceptional circumstances. If that person is very young, their age should be a primary consideration, but that is not clear in the Crimes Act, according to the watchdog's review. The President of the Law Council of Australia, Arthur Moses SC, says the Crimes Act needs to change.
When you are looking at bail, it's a child who is 10, 11, one would think that that should be something that the court takes into account as an exceptional circumstance.
Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santow says judges need to be able to weigh up all the circumstances.
Sometimes it will be appropriate to detain a child pending their trial for a terrorism offence, even if the child is ultimately found not guilty. But international human rights law requires special care to be taken because detention can have such extreme effects on a child.
Age is taken into account in other serious offences. For example, children are already excluded from mandatory sentencing for people smuggling.
If you're 12 or 15 or even 17, being detained can be the defining experience of your life, even if it's for a short time.
This is not just about locking up kids. Ultimately, we need to rehabilitate and reintegrate them back into our society. And I think that always has to be a fundamental focus when we're dealing with children.
Arthur Moses from the Law Council says the review's findings shouldn't lead to any appeals to sentences already handed down.
Hardly unlikely, but what this should do, though, is alert the federal government to amend the Crimes Act. We should not be flouting our international obligations.
The federal government received the report in November and only tabled it in Parliament last week on the day of the budget, the last possible day it could be made public. A spokesman for the Attorney General says the federal government is considering the review and will respond in due course.
Melissa Clark reporting there. You're listening to AEM. Australia's not the only country in the region gearing up for elections. In 10 days' time, Indonesia will vote for president. Incumbent Joko Widodo is well in front in the polls. His challenger, Prabowo Subianto, an ex-general, is now ramping up his attacks on foreigners and the press. Indonesia correspondent David Lipson with this report.
It's a classic hope versus fear campaign. Seeking his second term with a man of the people pitch, President Joko Widodo rode a horse and cart through the streets west of Jakarta as a festival of colour, music and dance swirled around him. He called it a democracy party. When you say a party, he told the crowd, it should be fun. It should not be creating fear. His opponent, Prabowo Subianto, had earlier addressed some 150,000 people packed inside Jakarta's main stadium, a sea of monochrome white. Dressed in his trademark safari suit, the ex-general laid out a dark view of Indonesia today, plagued by corruption, pillaged by foreigners.
Ibu Pertiwi sedang diperkosa.
Indonesia is being raped, he said. Our treasure is being taken away. At times, his anger erupted in English.
I am disgusted. Saya muak.
I've had enough, he shouted. This is not the republic I defended. It's not the republic I risked my life for. And then, addressing foreign correspondents directly, he said of the Indonesian people,
they don't want to be cheated again.
The ABC caught him backstage for clarification.
Daddy, ABC Australia, what is your message for foreign media?
The message is, I think, we want to execute democracy, real democracy. We want the will of the Indonesian people to be respected.
How have they not been respected or cheated in the past?
Last few months there's been too much blatant disregard of basic democratic practices. Freedom of speech, innocent people being arrested in jail.
Author of Reformasi Weekly, Kevin O'Rourke, is an analyst of Indonesian politics and policy.
The election is in many ways more about style than substance.
Still, he says, Indonesian voters do face a stark choice.
Prabowo is calling for a fundamental realignment of the economy. He clearly envisions even greater state control and close regulation of the economy. He also advocates much stricter protectionism, including a ban on food imports.
Taking aim at foreigners, journalists and a corrupt establishment, talk of trade protectionism. It's hard not to draw comparisons to Donald Trump. And another parallel, no one expects Prabowo to win, perhaps even him. He's now openly egging on his supporters to stage mass demonstrations if he loses. This is David Lipson in Jakarta. For AM.
Fresh fighting in the troubled North African nation of Libya has sparked concern around the Middle East and Europe. The United Nations called for a ceasefire as militias from the country's east met heavy resistance as they tried to conquer the capital, Tripoli. This new battle was started by a United States citizen who has the backing of some Arab nations, France, and possibly Russia. But he is sabotaging United Nations efforts to broker a lasting peace in the oil-rich and strategically important country. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Forces known as the Libyan National Army clash with troops supporting the internationally recognised government of Libya on the outskirts of the capital, Tripoli. The government side is fighting back against a surprise attack from the LNA. Spokesman Mohamed Khanouno says it's launched an operation called Volcano of Anger in defence of the city. We are pledging to our people that we will preserve the civil state, he says. We are inviting the delusional and brainwashed to surrender their weapons. The battle is over and we will not allow the militarisation of the nation. The attack on Tripoli came just over a week before a United Nations peace conference was due to start, which was aiming to schedule elections. There was hope the process would end the years of instability Libyans have endured since the fall of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. But Mary Fitzgerald, a journalist and researcher who specialises in Libya, says the LNA's attack on Tripoli has put all of that at risk.
The capital of Libya, it's home to the National Oil Corporation, it's home to the Central Bank of Libya, it's home to 1.2 million people. It's in no one's interest that this battle is allowed to drag on. And the question is how to nip it in the bud right now, who's willing to nip it in the bud, and how they would go about that.
The commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, is a US citizen who had support from foreign powers, including France, for his purported fight against Islamist terror.
So he's projected himself to foreign audiences as a secular a strong military leader who can basically eradicate Islamists of all stripes. So that narrative has been quite powerful, and quite a few people inside and outside Libya have bought into that.
But much of Khalifa Haftar's forces are made up of Saudi-inspired Islamist fighters who oppose democracy and want an ultra-conservative regime imposed in the country. Libyan lawyer and activist Alham Saudi says many Libyans were upset by the international support for Khalifa Haftar, whose forces are accused of war crimes.
The international community is regularly willing to turn a blind eye to these violations and do business with people who disregard due process and the rule of law, which is precisely why they shouldn't be surprised that these same actors break their word about peace processes and start military initiatives 10 days before the big showpiece peace process is going to happen.
European and Arab governments have supported different armed groups in Libya because they were willing to fight Islamic State terrorists or block illegal migration from Africa to Europe. But Elham Saudi says this approach has contributed to Libya's instability.
It all comes down to a very, very limited perspective of ensuring short-term gains in the battles that matter to these international actors, but actually a more long-term policy that is about state building and stabilization through the rule of law is actually good for everyone. And it's a much more stable and long-term vision. But unfortunately, that's lacking in the international actors.
That's Libyan lawyer and activist Elham Saudi, ending that report by Eric Torchek. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made a dramatic last-minute pitch to win the country's election, vowing to annex more of the West Bank. Palestinian leaders say they're appalled. The election promise comes as Mr. Netanyahu is in a hard-fought battle for his fifth term as Prime Minister. Sarah White reports.
As Israelis prepare to go to the polls tomorrow to vote in the national election, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made a last-minute appeal to nationalist voters, promoting Jewish settlement expansion.
I'm going to extend Israeli sovereignty, and I don't distinguish between settlement blocks and the isolated settlements. In my opinion, each block is an Israeli area and is under Israeli control. We, the Israeli government, have responsibility over these areas. I won't move these blocks to the Palestinian Authority.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has fallen behind his opponent, former top general Benny Gantz, in opinion polls, but he could still form a government which would keep him in power for a record fifth term. He's also facing corruption charges for allegedly receiving luxury gifts from multiple sources. It's a difficult choice for voters.
The Israeli people is very confused right now because we don't know which person to choose that he can make the despair disappear.
I think there are two important points. One, if corruption is important or not important. It's all about Bibi. If it's the end of his career, or he can continue with all his corruption, all his games around, and be a popular leader. The second point is, if the rightists are going to be more after the extremes and to be more rightist, or we are going to be more in the middle. So whether we are going to be more right after the extremes or we are going to stay in the middle.
Yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu's chief opponent, Benny Gantz, rallied supporters in Tel Aviv.
Friends, we will not let the Likud party be the largest party because we will be the largest party.
In the United States, President Donald Trump is buying into the campaign. He's warning that a Democratic victory in 2020 could leave Israel out there. Speaking to the Republican Jewish Coalition in Las Vegas, Trump says he made a snap decision to support the annexation of Golan Heights during a discussion with his top Middle East peace advisers.
I stood with Prime Minister Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu. How is the race going, by the way? How is it? Who's going to win the race? Tell me. I don't know. Well, it's going to be close. I think it's going to be close. Two good people. But I stood with your Prime Minister at the White House to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights.
Professor Gideon Rahat is from the Department of Political Science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He says Israeli elections boil down to ideology.
It's the rule of the majority versus the rule of law. It is liberal democracy versus illiberal democracy. It's about populism versus anti-populism. It's about the attack on the media, on the courts, on the old elite versus the so-called the people, which Netanyahu claims to represent.
But the move to extend Israeli sovereignty has enraged Palestinians, saying they will not be expelled from the area.
We will stay there. We will resist, you know, such behavior, such decision. And then, you know, the international community has to deal with us, you know, in that respect. So I think, you know, it's premature, you know, for Netanyahu to think that, he's a winner by thinking this way.
Israeli voters head to the polls tomorrow.
Sarah White reporting. A Four Corners expose has revealed that two Chinese-Australian writers were interrogated by Chinese officials over their ties to a former Turnbull government advisor. One of the two men, Yang Yanjun, was intercepted and detained by Chinese intelligence officials in January and accused of endangering state security. His wife has now broken her silence, telling the joint investigation by Four Corners, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald that Australia needs to fight harder for her husband's release. Lucy Carter reports.
In 2016, the then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull asked ASIO to conduct a classified investigation into Beijing's interference in Australia. Former Fairfax China correspondent John Garneau was handpicked by Mr Turnbull to partner with ASIO on the investigation. Its work, Mr Garneau has told Four Corners, he cannot comment on.
I have been involved in a classified project and I clearly can't talk about the contents of that project.
However, his friends, Chinese-Australian writers Yang Hengjun and Dr Feng Chongyi, have been targeted for comment. In 2017, Dr Feng says he was detained for several days in China by security officials and interrogated about his dealings with Mr Garneau.
In every detail, where we met, what kind of things we talked about. Actually, they knew a lot about him. Actually, during interrogation, they did not hide their anger with him.
Chinese security officials warned Dr Feng that if he disclosed the details of his interrogation, he would face criminal charges if he ever returned to China. John Garneau has told Four Corners it's concerning.
Look, leaving aside the work that I was doing, the fact that an Australian resident could be detained without any legal process in a hotel room in Guangzhou for the best part of a week shows a certain disregard or disparagement for our ability to defend the rights of our own citizens and our residents.
Liberal MP Andrew Hastie is the chair of the Federal Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security.
We've had multiple briefings at the top secret level from ASIO and other agencies that foreign interference is being conducted in Australia at an unprecedented level, and China is seeking to influence our elites, particularly our political and business elites, in order to achieve their strategic objectives.
In 2018, Yang Hengjun was also allegedly intercepted and questioned by Chinese officials in Sydney ahead of a meeting with John Garneau.
We're going to meet at 4. He arrived closer to 5 and he apologised because he said he'd been intercepted on the way. He'd been called by a Chinese official. He was asked about me, what was the nature of our relationship, what was I doing, what was I working on.
In January this year, Yang Hengjun was detained by Chinese intelligence officials when he flew from the US to Guangzhou and, according to his wife, denied access to lawyers. Mr Yang's wife, Xialiang Yang, has been banned from leaving China and has risked her own safety to speak out from Shanghai.
I think Australian government officials need to pay attention to citizens' basic human rights when they are overseas and show some concern for their situation. To be honest, I have been very disappointed. I hope the Australian government will show some basic care about this case.
Liberal MP Andrew Hastie says all Australians should fight for Mr Young's release.
Mr Young is an Australian citizen. He enjoys the rights and responsibilities of Australian citizenship. And so his detention, in a sense, is a detention of us all. We're all Australian citizens. How could we guarantee that we wouldn't be detained if we went to China?
The Australian government says it's doing what it can to secure Mr Young's release.
Lucy Carter with that report. And for more on this story, you can watch Four Corners tonight at 8:30. It wasn't known to doctors 10 years ago, but a new superbug has emerged that has health authorities around the world on high alert. The fungus Candida auris has now caused nearly 600 infections in the United States since 2013. It's been found in hospitals in Europe, South Africa and South Asia. Experts say it's not a problem for healthy people, but it is a worry for hospital patients with weak immune systems. Lexi Metherall reports.
Candida auris was unknown to doctors until a decade ago, but now the multi-drug-resistant fungus is a serious problem for hospitals around the world. Clinical Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases Christopher Heath works at the Royal Perth and Fiona Stanley Hospitals.
We're going to be looking very hard for it, particularly in people that have been in, for example, hospitals for more than 24 hours overseas. If they return and end up in a hospital locally. And I think that the same applies to other jurisdictions in Australia.
The first reported case of infection in Australia was in 2015 in a hospital in Western Australia. Last year, there were two cases in Victorian hospitals. Professor Heath says healthy people shouldn't worry. The real concern is for patients with weak immune systems in hospitals. For them, an infection can be fatal.
It has varied quite a bit in studies around the world. In patients who get the fungus growing in their bloodstream, about 30% of patients have died within a month of that being detected, which is pretty high for any organism.
It's thought the organism may have developed resistance through the use of antifungals for primary industry and for yeast infections in humans. It can now only be treated with drugs that are highly toxic to patients, and it shows up in the hospital rooms of infected patients even after days of deep cleaning. Professor Heath.
The rates of this fungus causing infections in some parts of India, for example, it's now gone from non-existent 10 years ago to now being the second most common cause of Candida causing bloodstream infections.
Since the beginning of the year, cases of Candida auris infection have had to be reported to the Centres for Disease Control in the US. But Australian authorities are still working on making it a nationally notifiable bug. Professor Heath.
We have most of the tools to address it as well, if not better than most other parts of the world. But the rate at which it's spread globally, I don't think it's going to be something that is a short-term challenge.
That's infectious diseases expert Christopher Heath ending Lexi Metherill's report. Australian regulators will hold an emergency meeting tonight to decide whether to ban a common type of breast implant linked to cancer. Textured implants have been associated with 90 cases of lymphoma and at least 4 deaths. Last week, French authorities banned certain types of breast implants and 3 other countries followed suit. Alison Branley from the Specialist Reporting Team has the story.
Professional ballerina Lily Bones was just 29 years old and at the top of her career when one costume change altered her life forever.
I actually found my lump jumping in and out of a costume. It was a quick change. I felt really alarmed when they said, oh, this is a solid lump, so you'll need a mammogram.
She was diagnosed with breast cancer and enrolled in a clinical trial where in one surgery she was given a double mastectomy and implants made by a company called Allergan.
I was told that my implants wouldn't rupture. I remember that quite distinctly.
A decade on, these implants have ruptured and started to contract. Lily is now a mother of a 2-year-old and is living with both the risk of silicone leaking and the looming threat of a rare type of blood cancer associated with her implants, called anaplastic large cell lymphoma. At an emergency meeting tonight, the Therapeutic Goods Administration will consider whether these implants should be banned because the latest research has raised the risk of the cancer to as high as nearly 1 in 3,000. In Australia, 90 women have developed the lymphoma and 4 women in Australia and New Zealand have died. The cancer is linked to a specific bacteria and has been known to take up to a decade to emerge. Last year, the regulator suspended the product's registration, but it still allowed implants registered before December to be used. Meanwhile, the ABC understands some Australian surgeons were still offering the brand of implants to patients at the start of this year. Now, a group of women have approached legal firm Slater and Gordon about a possible class action against its makers. Professor Anand Deva is a global authority on the rare cancer and will be at the TGA meeting tonight. He says it's time for Australian authorities to take decisive action.
But we'll also present some new research. We've got a paper coming out next month. Our findings show a risk that is rising. I would hope that they would make a decision, you know, sooner rather than later. I think simply to delay or sit on your hands at this point is probably not a good way to go.
Last week, French authorities withdrew 7 brands of textured implants from the market, including newer polyurethane implants. Canada, the Netherlands and Colombia have also followed suit. But in the US, its regulator says it still wants further information. For women like Lily Bones, that's not good enough.
I've got enough to worry about. I don't need other issues to be playing on my mind. I don't want to think about silicone migrating. They should put women's health first.
That's cancer patient Lily Bones ending that report by Alison Branley. And in a statement, a spokesman for the makers of textured implants, Allergan, said the decision by French regulators was not based on any new evidence and that it stands by the risk-benefit profile of its products. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi there, I'm Alice Brennan. If you love live music, then you've probably been to a show organised by Michael Chugg or by Jack Yudzik. In the 2000s, they were behind some of the biggest Australian and international gigs. Think Robbie Williams, Elton John, Shania Twain. What Chugg didn't know was his business partner Yudzik was actually running a Ponzi scheme. Look for Background Briefing in the ABC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.